We're talking with Ray Waru about his new book, Secrets and Treasures, based on information he obtained from the National Archives of New Zealand. When we come back, we continue the conversation about the oldest document he saw, a letter from Captain Cook, and then get into your phone calls. Stay with us for Coast to Coast AM. Ray, let's continue the discussion about Captain Cook. Did you get to hold this document in your hand?
Yes, I did. Yes, I got to hold it. It's an interesting thing about archives, that they bring you so close to people who have lived so long ago. And I'm sure this is so with the signatures of presidents and great Americans. But to be so close to the signature of the man who discovered New Zealand for the European world, James Cook, I thought was quite an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing about paper archives, and I think I mentioned before, it's something that's possibly going to be lost as we store everything in the cloud and in digital form, that handling letters that were written by famous people or handling documents that were just from ordinary people, I think is something that's going to be lost in the world of archives in the future. But this letter from James Cook was a really interesting thing to hold, an interesting thing to see, and kind of sad, too, because when he wrote it, he would not have known that this was going to be his last voyage, and Cook never returned from this voyage. In 1778, he was killed in Hawaii.
Chopped up, too, right? Cut up.
Yeah.
So he wrote this thing to his basically his second in command, saying, if you're not there, forget it. And the guy was in jail.
The guy was in jail, yes. His second captain was called Charles Clark, and he was in jail because he'd been arrested because he'd gone surety for a debt that his brother had owed, and his brother had absconded. So he got to carry the can, which kind of, history is full of quirky little things when you start looking at it.
I got some folks on the line. I want to ask you one other quick story before we do that. It's about a dolphin named Jack. I'd never heard of this before.
Polaris Jack, yes. Well, he was a dolphin who in the 20th century was famous for guiding ships through a particular stretch of water between the two islands of New Zealand. And he was beloved of people. People came to see him from all around the world. He was on newspapers and magazines all around the world. And he is supposed to have been the only animal ever to have his own law, because a law was passed to protect Polaris Jack specifically and his species as a resource dolphin. So he is supposed to be the only animal in the world with his own protective law. Really interesting. He kept doing it for years. He was regular as clockwork. Ships would take off. They would get to a particular part of the water in Cook Strait between the North Island and the South Island of New Zealand, and there would Polaris Jack be, and he would guide them through. He would stay with them for a while and then go back and find another ship. It's a really interesting story. Around the New Zealand coast, because we, of course, have a lot of coast, and we spend a lot of time on beaches in New Zealand. There are lots of stories of dolphins that spend a lot of time with people. There's another famous dolphin called Upo, who played with kids for years and years and years, and eventually, as sometimes happens in these cases, he was shot foolishly by somebody.
Isn't that part of the story about Jack, too, that Jack would guide these ships back and forth, and then somebody took a shot at him, and he never came back?
Somebody took a shot at him from a particular ship, and he never guided that ship again, but he went back to other ships. Nobody knows really what happened to him. He probably died of natural causes, and from some of the very few photographs of Polaris Jack that exist, he may have been an older animal, and he may have simply died of natural causes. There was a story that somebody thought they had found his body at some point, and there was a worry at the time that he may have been attacked by sailors. But he simply disappeared at a particular point in time, and nobody really knows what happened to him. But yeah, somebody did take a pot shot at him, and he never went back to that boat ever again.
Wow, that's amazing, though. He's continued to guide other ships, just not that one. That's a pretty cool
That's
story.
right.
West of the Rockies, Jeff. Good morning, Jeff.
How you doing, George and Mr. Waru? Yes, I've always been fascinated with the various designs of UFO crafts. Many are believed to be saucer-shaped, but others are shaped like large tops or elongated cigars. All of these crafts utilize the same ability, using some type of particle beam laser light to elevate human beings upward into these crafts. My question is this, Mr. Waru. Do you believe that these are indeed extraterrestrial crafts visiting us from another realm or dimension, or do you believe that these crafts are really being operated by governments, particularly Western governments, and that they're just using these crafts and these functions as a practice or sort of a practice run on the public? And I'll take your answer off there.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, I think I'm very open-minded about what UFOs are and what these particular craft are. I have to say, I certainly believe that intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe. I can't believe that we're all there is. And the possibility of intelligent life interacting with our world is certainly something that you have to consider. But I'd be open-minded on just exactly what these craft are that people may be seeing, whether they might be extraterrestrial, whether they might be secret government craft. I think somebody else might have an answer for that.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if our governments, yours or mine or ours, has a giant orange globe that's been seen over New Zealand for a long time. They certainly haven't rolled them out yet from the black vaults. We're going to first time caller David in Tennessee. Hi, David.
Hey, good morning, fellas. How you doing?
Okay.
This is something I seen. Me and my family seen when we was like, well, was it fall of '69 or 1970, right there? But we seen two balls of light join together and go down over these abandoned ore mines. They shot a beam of light into like the ore mines, and then they had a light that shot up into space, like alternating. And well, when they decided to leave, they cut the light off, raised up, and shot up into space. I know we didn't have technology then, and we don't have it now. So what could I have seen, or we seen?
I don't know. Ray, you want to take a shot at it?
Well, I think it's interesting that quite often sightings like David just described then are actually quite similar to things that are seen in this part of the world. You know, it's interesting that people who are separated by time and space and geography should be seeing the same thing. So I don't have an answer for it, but I certainly think it's interesting that people see similar things in the sky.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's amazing because we don't have technology to do that now. So, you know, it's amazing. I was 10 years old when I seen this, 10 or 11. And, you know, it's just amazing because we don't have it now.
Oh, well, no argument here. You're preaching to the choir. I mean, some of the most interesting UFO cases are ones from 40, 50 years ago. Today, you could say that some of what people are seeing in the sky are advanced weapons, secret spy planes, platforms, things of that sort. But it's hard to say that we had those things 50 years ago. That's for sure. Thank you, David. Appreciate it. You know, Ray, I was. One of the impressions I came away from your book with is the similarities between our countries in so many historical ways. One that jumps out at me is the treatment of indigenous people.
Well, yes, I mean, that's, I suppose, something that I'm particularly interested in because I am partly a New Zealand Maori. So I'm interested in how, you know, our tribes have fared since the period of colonization and into the present. And by and large, though, we have done particularly well. Some people might not think it's a perfect world, and it's not a perfect world. But like some American Indian tribes, we have taken the full reins of modern commerce. Maori fishing companies are the largest fishing companies in New Zealand. We run huge forestry enterprises here. And although, like I guess the black population in many states in America, we represent more people in prison than our percentage of the population should. But Maori, by and large, in New Zealand are doing well, and you can see that happening in some of the archives. But equally, you can see the sources of kind of racist attitudes and attitudes that have tried to put people down. And of course, we had a long period of interracial wars, almost at the same time that you were fighting a civil war, almost exactly the same time in the 1860s. There was a kind of civil war here between Maori and colonists, as there were between the North and South America. So another interesting and probably sad similarity between us.
Well, a lot of the documents that you outline in the book deal with the treatment of the Maoris and indigenous people there their ability, I guess, you know, the government attempting to make amends for some of the crimes that were committed earlier. And in the same vein, similarity to what happened here in our country is suffrage, women's suffrage. I guess New Zealand was ahead of the curve on that.
Well, we were. I mean, it's there were two great treasures, I suppose, in our archive. One is a thing that we call the Treaty of Waitangi, which was signed in 1840 between the Maori people of New Zealand and the British Crown, and it kind of set the stage for colonization. And Maori probably thought it was supposed to be a treaty between equals, whereas the British colonials certainly didn't think it was. But it certainly, in modern times, has been the foundation of a stronger sense of equality between the races and a stronger sense of New Zealand as a nation of at least two peoples, but two people that at least have to get on together. Whereas the women's suffrage petition was a kind of an expression of New Zealand as a kind of groundbreaker in all sorts of things. For a little country, New Zealand has done quite a lot to push the envelope on a lot of issues. It was our Rutherford who first split the atom, and we've done a lot of things, including giving women the vote before anybody else in the world. Now, there's some dispute about just exactly what that first vote meant, but we gave women the vote. We were the first self-governing country in the world to give all women the vote in 1893. Some states in America had a limited kind of franchise. Some women could vote, and could vote in some states, but not all. And some places in the world allowed women to vote in some kind of elections if they were property in, for some other reasons. But New Zealand was the first independent country in the world, the first nation in the country in the world, to give all its women, including Maori women, the vote without having a property franchise. So the first election after 1893, everybody of voting age in New Zealand could vote, which was, for its time, earth-shattering, really, and quite revolutionary. American women didn't get the vote until later on in the 20th century, and other places followed.
I want to talk about the ties to the British Crown. You are an independent country, of course, but I'm curious about how strong those ties are. But we've got on east of the Rockies, Matthew in Florida with a question. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Mr. Napser. The reason why I'm calling very parallel to the I got on the show late there, sir, about the planes flying from to Christchurch with the lights. During 1944, my grandfather was a navigator on a Wellington bomber. And on their way back from the mainland of Europe, crossing over what would be the in between Norway and Great Britain, headed toward just north of Hull, England, on the east coast, they were followed by lights. And my grandfather told my grandmother, and that thus he passed, and she had relayed the story to us. Blue, light blue and yellow lights surrounding the plane. And once they were about a mile or two off the coast, gone like a flash. But they were circling the plane, flying around. The gunner on the back of the plane actually passed out of disbelief of what they were looking at. And it was about a 15-minute to 20-minute incident. As soon as they hit the water, followed them all the way across the water, and then gone, shot in different directions, the lights. But I'll never forget the story. I'm 40 years old now, and my grandmother told it to me when I was about 15, about a year after my grandfather passed.
So Foo Fighters, basically, it's a description of Foo Fighters.
Okay. I've heard the phrase, but didn't know what it was.
Well,
that's
Ray?
A great story. Actually, there are lots of stories like that, I think, from all around the world, particularly during the Second World War. I guess possibly because it's the first time, really, that lots of aircraft had been in the sky. Certainly, there weren't as many aircraft in the sky in the First World War. And there were lots of reported sightings of these balls of light effects following planes, tracking planes, moving around aircraft. And as I said, the Germans had them and thought they were British weapons, and the British thought they were German weapons. So nobody knows.
And true for the Japanese as well. Did you see any documents about Foo Fighter type episodes from the World War II era?
Not specifically, because most of the documents that were released and that we looked at in the file were from the 1950s, so they were after the war. But Foo Fighters are a really interesting thing, because these were observations made by trained pilots. And also because they occurred before the flying saucer phenomena really got going. These were people seeing things that they had never seen before. They weren't in any particular state of mind to expect to see them. They were just there, and I think Foo Fighters are a really interesting phenomena, really, that nobody's ever been able to explain.
True. Yeah, Matthew, that's a great story. It's clearly those things were happening before there were UFO movies, before Close Encounters, so you can't really blame it on that. Cultural influences.
No, that's right. And there were quite a lot of reports in the war from, you know, air forces on both sides, all sides.
I want to get into some of the documents related to war, in particular Gallipoli. I don't think we have time enough before the break to jump into that topic, but were there any places that you were not allowed to go because of sensitivity, even historic sort of battles where you wanted to get into the files and they said no?
No, they were quite open. All of the military records that are open were open to see. In fact, I was trying to find something which I couldn't find, but they were all open.
That's about battles and things. What about technology? Obviously, nuclear secrets, you couldn't see any of those.
No, actually, that would be right. I was mainly focusing on the First and Second World War, so you probably could be right about that. We had, before our anti-nuclear legislation in the 80s, we were on the path to building nuclear power stations, and in fact, we were in sync with everybody else in the world at the time in embracing nuclear power as a miracle source of power for the future. And I guess then...
That changed. Yeah, I want to wait, Ray. That's a good topic. We'll get into that more. We'll talk about nuclear secrets and nuclear issues and take more of your calls right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We continue our conversation with Ray Waru about secrets and treasures from the New Zealand National Archives right after this in our final segment on Coast to Coast AM. Ray, I mentioned a bit ago I wanted to get into this. It's hard for we Americans to understand exactly the relationship between the former colonies, I guess members of the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, and the Crown these days. Some of the documents that you reference in the book suggest great reverence for the Queen. I don't know if she's on your money these days, but can you explain what the feelings and what the ties are these days?
Well, there were very, very strong ties with the British Crown and with Britain for most of our history, really, from the late 19th century, really right up until the 70s. Britain took most of our produce, and most of our immigrants came from Britain. And we were technically had the Queen of England as our head of state, and she still is our head of state. So there are warm ties between Britain and New Zealand, but over the last few years, there's a rising Republican movement and feelings that we no longer should be tied to the British Crown. Oddly enough, our highest court used to be the English Privy Council. So we didn't have a Supreme Court. The last port of call of appeal for major cases actually were tried in London. But that was changed recently, and now we have our own Supreme Court, just like the United States. The Queen is still a head of state, but I think nowadays the sense that a British monarch is necessary for a country like New Zealand is changing. It's one of those very touchy subjects that is going to have to find the right time and the right place really to play out to see whether or not the New Zealand public ever wants to remove the Queen as head of state. There was a strong feeling during the period where Prince Charles and Diana had such bad press that the present Queen of England, Elizabeth II, would be the last monarch on the British throne, and New Zealand and some other countries would then change the system, become Republican, and Charles would never become king. That's changed, I think, quite a lot over the last few years. People have now accepted Prince Charles, who is Queen Elizabeth's son, and his marriage to his new wife. They've also, people have very warmly responded to William, Charles's son, and I'm sure Americans watched the royal wedding last year.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
I think it's one of those things that goes up and down, but at the moment is probably going up a little bit. There's still a very strong connection between Britain and New Zealand, and New Zealand is part of the British Commonwealth, which has all sorts of trading and sport and kind of cultural connections. But as our trade, you know, no longer goes solely to the United Kingdom, and as trade guides politics and all sorts of things around the world, New Zealand is becoming more closely connected to Asia and more closely connected to the United States and Australia. So although the bonds are there, they are changing, and they probably will change in the future.
A similar question, the bonds to the U.S. that you mentioned. You know, so many Americans are now familiar with New Zealand. We joked about it, but it's serious in a sense because of the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit movies. We've seen the beautiful scenery, and I know it's stimulated a lot of tourism. I just wonder, do Americans emigrate to New Zealand? Is it easy to move there?
I think it's relatively easy to move here. It's quite a lot. I mean, you don't notice huge numbers of Americans, but I mean, in the film industry, James Cameron has bought a giant spread just up from where Peter Jackson lives in New Zealand. And there was some talk that James Cameron was going to eventually come and live here full time. So I guess some Americans, there was a period where quite a lot of internet people tended to come here. I think not as many Americans come here as Asians do, for example. But there was also a period when quite a lot of Americans came here to avoid larger cities and to find a kind of clean, green, quiet, slightly oldie-worldy sort of existence that they couldn't find in the United States. So I think we welcome Americans, and I think a few are coming to live here.
Well, there are some strains, nuclear energy, nuclear weapons being at the core of that. I'll come back to that in a moment. I want to get to the caller, Steve in Louisville, Kentucky, on the East of the Rockies line. Hi, Steve. Good morning. Steve, are you there? Hello?
Trained pilots, but I've never heard anyone describe in any specificity what type of training, other than discerning one airplane from another, do pilots have in their training?
Ray, I'm not sure if you heard all that question. I think what he's saying is, in these UFO cases, why are pilots better witnesses than anyone else?
Well, I would say, for one thing, pilots would be a group of people who are trained to be particularly aware of what's happening around them, because they need to be flying an aircraft. I think also they are trained to have instincts and to have specific knowledge of things like height, airspeed, direction of the compass, what the weather is doing, where the sun, moon, and stars are. So I think pilots have a kind of training that makes them better witnesses of things, of aerial phenomena, basically.
Yeah, Steve, I think the point you would make is that being able to recognize what it is that's flying around up there is a pretty key skill, especially when you're seeing something that doesn't match anything you've seen before.
I'll let you go. I would direct you to two bad words on this show, but James Oberg, I don't know if he has a website or not, but he has listed in journals in the past 70 to 80 phenomena that most people don't even know exist that could be confused with some quote-unquote UFOs.
Well, no argument here. I think, most serious UFO researchers would agree that 90 to 95% of all UFO sightings are misidentifications of prosaic objects or phenomena. No argument about that. It's the interesting cases are the ones where you have physical descriptions, multiple eyewitnesses, and then, for example, the cases that Ray was talking about, radar sightings that match what the witnesses are saying over a long period of time or a long distance.
If it only takes 15 seconds, can I say real quick an observation I had that I apologize. The gentleman that comes on the show sometimes, I'm not online, so I have a hard time connecting with people. But I wanted to tell him this observation, and I caught him at a bad time, and I wasn't able. He wasn't able to answer my take my observation. I promise it'll only take 10 seconds.
Okay.
It was about a half an hour before twilight. The only reason I saw it was I was petting a dog across the yard from a fence. I turned to my right for some reason, and the best I can describe it, it was like seeing the Pleiades. You know what I'm talking about? The Pleiades,
yeah.
In the near Taurus in the
yeah,
sky.
Yeah, the seven sisters, right? Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes. It looked. That's the best way I can describe it. It was like looking at the Pleiades in the daytime, and I can't. Although it seemed like they were kind of they weren't dark against the sky, which was still light, but they weren't real bright, but they were whitish versus darkish, you know. And I was going to run in and get my binoculars, but about 10 seconds later, I turned my head for some reason, look at the dog or something. I looked back, it was gone. But I just wanted to get that observation in on the show, because I've never been able to get that to anybody. But I've never heard of anything like that since or before, you know.
Well, me neither, Steve, but I appreciate you sharing us the story with us, and I agree with your observation. Pilots can make mistakes, and I'm sure a lot of misidentifications have happened. It's that handful of cases with multiple kinds of data that are difficult to explain away, but thanks for the call. West of the Rockies, Adrian in California. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, George. By the way, I've been following you since the late 80s. I think you're doing a great job. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks a lot.
My question is for your guest, Ray Waru, is There was a case, and I recently saw a documentary, a suburban UFO mystery concerning the Westall case in April 6, 1966. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I find it absolutely fascinating. My question is, during that time, were there a lot of UFO sightings in New Zealand as well?
I'm going to try and reach for something if I can answer that. In the 60s, there was some. I'm looking at, I don't know how comprehensive this list is that I'm looking at, but I'm counting 15 sightings of various places around the country.
Is that for the entire decade, Ray?
It's for the entire decade in this list, but as I say, I'm not quite sure how comprehensive this this particular list is, which was from a New Zealand website. So it's hard to say, but there were clearly sightings at around that time, and there were quite a lot of sightings around the world in the 60s. It was a busy period.
Adrian, did you want to make a point about it?
To New Zealand, I was just kind of curious about that because I just recently saw the documentary, just absolutely compelling. So I was wondering your opinion of that and as it relates to New Zealand.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know, but I mean, New Zealand actually seems to participate when there are waves of sightings around the world. And partly, I suppose, it could be that people are picking up from press reports. But when you look back over the history of sightings through 100 years, you can still see that waves of sightings do exist around the world at various periods, and New Zealanders sometimes see the same things that people are seeing in Europe and in other parts of the world. So I think that's an interesting phenomena.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Adrian. I mentioned this earlier, Ray, about the one source of friction between our two countries is nuclear power, nuclear weapons. I guess sort of New Zealanders had a front row seat for some of the nuclear tests that the French conducted and developed an understandable sensitivity to it. Would you talk about the documents you saw in that regard?
Well, I mean, that's true. I think one of the reasons why New Zealand developed a specific antipathy towards nuclear weapons was because of the proximity of nuclear testing in Tahiti. We sent frigates and we sent huge armadas of small ships with lots of people, lots of sailors in New Zealand, sailed into the nuclear test zones because we felt that if France wanted to have nuclear tests, they should have them in France. But they brought it down to the Pacific, and it caused lots of damage here. Even before that, though, when America was testing and the British were testing at Christmas Island and Bikini Atoll, New Zealand was actually involved then in observing those tests. So for a period after the war, and at the beginning, I suppose, of what you might call the Cold War, New Zealanders actually were involved in developing. Well, I mean, New Zealanders supported the development of nuclear arsenals around the world, and I talk in the book about an operation that occurred just after the war called Operation Grapple. And we were involved as observers. This was in the 1950s. We were observers with that. And for some reason, the New Zealand public changed its mind. I don't think the government changed its mind overnight about whether or not it would support nuclear weapons or support the development of nuclear weapons. But the New Zealand public, over a period of years, certainly did, and it took a lot of years. And in fact, when I discovered the Operation Grapple material from the late 1950s, I was quite surprised to see how closely involved New Zealand observers were at some of that testing. And another thing I do in the book is I found a series of maps that were supposed to protect Wellington in the case that it was targeted by Soviet nuclear weapons. I don't think they ever needed it, and the map that I looked at was just a little bit moth-eaten, and I certainly hope it never has to be used in the future. But New Zealand embraced the idea of nuclear power and, I suppose, nuclear weapons for a period, and then changed its mind. And that has caused friction between New Zealand government and the US government since the 80s. But as I said before, I think a lot of that is changing now. And in fact, New Zealand military troops are in fact exercising with American forces. And there's certainly a lot more warmth between the heads of our government. And we are still participating with special service forces, SAS forces, in Afghanistan. I think there is much, much less antipathy than there used to be between two governments, and certainly I think none at all between our peoples.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of admiration warm feelings between the two countries. It's just guessing. That's just how I feel. We didn't get a chance to get into nuclear energy for peaceful uses. Your country is basically turned away from that as well, especially, I would imagine, since Fukushima.
Well, it turned away from it when we had the anti-nuclear legislation in the 80s. Although I looked at some of the planning we were doing for nuclear power stations, and oddly enough, we were planning to put a nuclear power station where there had been a famous UFO sighting at a harbour just north of Auckland called the Kaipara Harbour. And there was a pilot who made a series of UFO sightings. His name was Bruce Cathy, and he developed a theory about grid lines around the world. And he plotted grid lines across New Zealand and claimed that he had seen a number of UFOs during his work as a commercial pilot in New Zealand. And he claimed to have seen two large sunken UFOs at this harbour where we were going to site the first nuclear power station.
Wow, quite a coincidence. Yeah. Ray, I really appreciate you coming on the program. Secrets and Treasures is a great book. I recommend people go ahead and get it. I hope you enjoyed yourself here.
I did. Thank you very much. It's been great to be on the show, and have a great inauguration day.
Thank you very much, and hope you come to visit us sometime. I want to thank also our earlier guest, Jeffrey Notkin, author of Meteorite Hunting and Rockstar Adventures of a Meteorite Man. And, of course, thanks to my crew there, our crew at Premier, Nathan, Gina, Lex, and Dan. And I'll be back next Sunday night, everyone. Good night.